No, you can adjust firmly. No, it's also on the back. Get the back got a wrong.
I must say, this is the first introduction to our latest equipment. We have the society's recently purchased the data projector and the laptop.
It works.
It sort of does too. All right, off you go.
Well, Mr. President, members of the St Kilda Historical Society, you're the guinea pigs. We're doing this about 9 times around Victoria, and you're the very first, and you can see we had some teething problems. All my copies of the slides had some vague inscription on them, and they wouldn't open on the normal laptop. We had to rush home and do another set of slides, which don't have the names on them, but however, let's get on. So thank you for inviting us, sir, and my colleague Don and his wife Kathy, we're pleased to be here. Australia is an island continent, and if you study a world map, you may be surprised to learn that about 70% of the world's surface is covered by water. Our country was discovered by Captain James Cook in 1770. In 1950, as the President mentioned, I was appointed aide-de-camp to His Excellency the Governor-General, Sir William Mackell. At the National Library in Canberra, I was able to get my hands on Captain James Cook's original Endeavour Journal to learn. The entry for Sunday the 6th of May 1770. In the evening, the yawl returned from fishing, having caught 2 stingrays, weighing about 600 pounds. The great quantity of stingrays found in the place occasioned me in giving the name Stingrays Harbour. He then crossed that out in his journal, and his next try was Botanist Harbour. That's crossed out. Then Botanist Bay was given a run, but it too was erased before finally Cook settled on Botany Bay. The name survived to be still used today. It was quite a thrill to get the original journal in my hands, and it was quite unusual to be able to do it. We were settled in Australia, albeit initially by convicts, transported by sea from the British Isles. Our imports, our exports are essentially using the sea. The oceans that surround us have formed a protective barrier. Prior to the development of aircraft, we were totally dependent upon the sea to travel to and from the rest of the world. I suggest that we in Australia need to look to the sea. In the early stages of Australia's development, the Royal Navy provided our shield of defence, mainly in Sydney. Gold was discovered at Ballarat in August of 1851. James Reagan and John Dunlop found it, to be followed by a number of other sites. A good deal of the precious metal was shipped off to England, carried in sailing ships from both, and the Victorian government and the local populace were very fearful of attacks by the Russians and the French upon both the stored stocks of gold held for shipment and on the vessels carrying it off to Europe. The defence of Port Phillip. Port Phillip Bay is roughly 20 miles by 30 miles from the heads to Port Melbourne in the old scale. I'm old enough to still use the old bits. Naval Reserve training commenced in 1855 with the formation of the Sandridge and Williamstown companies of the Victorian Naval Brigade. By 1864, there were 68-pounder batteries mounted round the bay at Sandridge, Lagoon, Emerald Hill Central Battery, the St Kilda Battery, the Wright House Battery, the lighthouse battery at Williamstown near the railway pier. That was the largest. They had 8 by 68 pounders, and at the entrance to Port Phillip, both at Point Nepean and Queenscliff. In 1862, there was rather an embarrassing incident. A Russian warship had entered and fired a salute. They couldn't return it by the Queenscliff battery. Why? They just didn't have any ammunition. Their opinions then aired that the Russians were merely testing out their defences. Next slide, please. On the afternoon of January the 26th, 1865, Captain Waddell sailed the Confederate armed raider Shenandoah into Hobson's Bay. There she is slipped at Williamstown to take on food and water. The Melburnians flocked to the raider, who was also quietly attempting to recruit some crewmen. The Victorian government sought to ignore that. Amongst the locals, some were for the raider, others were against it. In fact, they got 42 men actually recruited and transported off in 4 boats from the Sandridge Beach, pursued by the police, but they managed to elude the police. This breach of neutrality was to cost the British government quite dearly. After the war, an international tribunal awarded the United States against Britain $15.5 million, an immense sum in those days. Shenandoah went off and went to the North Pacific, where she knocked over most of the American whaling fleet, not aware that peace had been declared. She sank a number of ships well after the war was over, and only after they captured a newspaper from a ship they sank did they realise that the American Civil War was over. The warship had been the former Sea King, bought by Confederate agents in London, fitted with 18 guns at sea, and renamed the CSS Shenandoah. Our early Victorian governor was Captain Sir Charles Hotham, a British naval officer. So the Royal Navy continued its influence on Victoria. Sir Charles served but for a short period from May the 22nd to December 31, 1855. Thank you. That's Town Pier at Port Melbourne. In the Gold Rush days, as you can see, it was crowded with shipping. The very next pier was Railway Pier, where the coal used to come in and go off to the gasworks at Port Melbourne, demolished in 1850. The state of Victoria was to develop the largest of all the colonial navies. They negotiated their first warship, an 880-ton sloop, HMCSS, the SS denotes steam sloop, Victoria 1. Thank you. There she is being launched in London in 1855. She served over 1860 to 61 in New Zealand during the First Taranaki War, thus becoming the first Australian unit ever to serve in an overseas war. Next. That's the swivel link from Victoria that's down at Queenscliff at the moment. So we've retained one, what's a fairly big article, from the original ship. From the early days of settlement in Victoria, the importance of Sandridge, obviously the former name for Port Melbourne, in defence was very much recognised. A site on the beach would be ideal for a gunpowder reserve. In 1861, an area of the beach near the lagoon, which was to be the future building site for Lonsdale, was reserved for military purposes. A 55-year-old ship, HMS Nelson, was acquired for training purposes, and the Victoria Treasurer arranged for the construction in the UK of the Monitor Cerberus. Thank you. There's the Cerberus, had 10-inch guns, named after the three-headed dog that guards the entrance to Hades. And Britain agreed to pay 80% of the cost. The new ship arrived on station in Victoria in 1871. It's a tragedy that this monitor, the only survivor of its type worldwide, was sunk as a breakwater off the beach of the Melbourne suburb of Black Rock. Thank you. There she is today, looking rather sad, and there trying to save her, but I think they might be too late. In 1883, two first-class gunboats, two second-class and a first-class torpedo boat were ordered at a cost of £84,000.
Thank you.
The Victorian colonial ships bore names such as Victoria 1 and 2, Albert, Childers, Lonsdale and Nepean. There's Childers with the tall funnel alongside. A number of merchant ships were also fitted out. A mine layer called Miner, the Melbourne Harbour Trust Hoppers Batman and Faulkner, the tugs Gannet and Eagle, the Yacht Commissioner and the Launch Spray. 1886 saw the arrival of the turnabout torpedo boat, launched as Gordon, designed to turn rapidly in the water after discharging her torpedoes. Lady Locke, thank you. Oh, it's a bit hard to see. The light's on. But one go off, I can catch the one. I think I can see. She had one 6-inch gun and two 1-inch Nordenfels. On May the 25th, 1889, the yacht Vulcan was launched, a 75-ton mine layer. She transferred from Navy control to the permanent engineers, as the Army was responsible for controlled mine laying. From this distance, that appears a rather odd decision. Naval mining at sea run by the Army, but I parade my bias. It is interesting that the defence budget in Victoria 1890 of £145,000, the Navy scored £32,000, 6 shillings and fourpence. I found myself pondering on the 6 and 4 pence and wondering what that would bring to our naval defence. Thank you. That's the Countess of Hopetown, was laid down in 1890 in Yarrow in England, the last ship to be ordered by the Victorian Navy. She had a speed of 24 knots, quite a lot in those days, was the largest and most powerful torpedo boat in all the colonial navies. She was also the first to feature a twin and rotating torpedo mounting. Prior to that, the torpedo mountings had been fixed, and you had to point the ship to where you wanted to fire it to make sure your torpedoes would go in the right direction. Here they were able to rotate it, and that was a big difference. In 1895, Albert and Victoria were withdrawn from service. The auxiliary gunboats and Nelson was in reserve, and we were left only with Cerberus and 5 torpedo boats. With Federation on January the 1st, 1901, all previous state colonial navies were on March the 1st transferred to the new Commonwealth. Melbourne became the location for the administrative headquarters. The Department of Defence, which was headed by Captain Muirhead Collins, was the new permanent secretary. And the Commonwealth Naval Forces were under its director, Captain Creswell. Thank you. A private boys' brigade had been founded at Ballarat in 1903. This gentleman joined the Navy because he'd been to see the Great White Fleet that arrived in 1908. He was so impressed that he joined the Navy in 1914. He lived to be 106 and only died in 2005. Eventually got a commission and became a lieutenant. The old colonial post office at the corner of Bay and Rouse Streets was acquired by the federal government in 1911, as the new Department of Posts and Telegraph had no further use for it. The first brick building erected in 1912 for the RAN and the Commonwealth was the drill hall adjacent to the old post office. I took my medical there as a candidate for the Naval College in 1935. The drill hall now became the new Port Melbourne Reserve Depot, and all training was carried out until the outbreak of World War II, when it commissioned as Cerberus III. But with 3 separate naval establishments, all carrying the same name, and only distinguished by the next Roman numeral, chaos reigned. Everybody got the wrong signals, and eventually they decided they'd call it Lonsdale, named after William Lonsdale, the first agent general for the government and the police magistrate. Japan and the United States. Japanese and United States relations were at a new low in 1907. Japan had been victorious against the Chinese on land and the Russians at sea. Many in the US believed that the US West Coast and Hawaii were vulnerable to attack from Japan. Teddy Roosevelt considered that a show of strength by the Navy might deter the Japanese. And there's the part of the Great White Fleet. They were called white because they were painted white. They also were steaming on coal and made a lot of smoke. They had lovely gold scrollwork on the bows, red, white and blue, and they made quite a picture. Australia hadn't seen one battleship, let alone 16. So these were the Atlantic Fleet, and he ordered them to do a worldwide cruise, and he farewelled them from Hampstead Roads in his yacht, the Mayflower, on December the 16th, 1907, to commence a round-the-world voyage that went until February the 22nd, 1909. So they were away from home 15 months. The Panama Canal was unfinished, so they had to get round to Cape Horn to get into the Pacific Ocean. Over the 15 years before the Great White Fleet sailed, the balance of power was shifting in the Pacific. After the Sino-Japanese War and the Russian conflict of 1904-05, the pendulum had swung to a strengthening Japanese Navy. The Russian Navy was destroyed at Tsushima. The French Navy was in decline. The Brits withdrew their battleships and took them home, leaving Japan with the biggest single fleet in the Pacific. This was of great concern to Teddy Roosevelt, hence his orders to the Great White Fleet. There's a cartoon depicting the Great White Fleet circling the Pacific Ocean and tightening its grip on the ocean rather than leaving it to the Japanese. Australia, Britain and the Great White Fleet. After Federation, as we noted, combined all the state navies to form Commonwealth Naval Forces, but essentially we still relied on the Royal Navy to shield and protect us. Both Britain and Australia were working off two different agendas. The British Admiralty wanted Australian ships to act as they were required to suit the needs of the British Empire. The Australian Prime Minister Alfred Deakin wanted more independence for the infant Australian Navy. He sought to put Australia's needs and its defence as his primary priority. He preempted the Australian World War II Prime Minister John Curtin, who after the fall of Singapore in 1942, turned his eyes to the east, to the United States for alliance and support. Deakin ignored the Colonial Office in London. He contacted President Roosevelt direct, invited his Great White Fleet to visit Australia. He agreed that his ships would visit Sydney, Melbourne, and lastly Albany for coal for their next journey. This was the commencement of an alliance between Australia and the United States that still flourishes in 2008. In 2001, we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the ANZUS Treaty. To mark that event, at the Washington Navy Yard on September the 10th, 2001, the day before 9/11, President Bush presented the bell from USS Canberra, named after HMAS Canberra, sunk at the Battle of Savo Island, to the Australian Prime Minister John Howard. I'd been sunk in Canberra in 1942, and my son Raymond had been christened aboard USS Canberra alongside Station Pier on Mother's Day in 1967, using the bell as the christening point. Both my wife and myself were present in Washington for the impressive bell handing over ceremony. John Howard came down and met us and said, "Tomorrow I'm going to Arlington Cemetery to visit the grave of the one Australian buried in Arlington. In, during the war, a pilot officer Milne was flying an aircraft with a mixed crew. They crashed in New Guinea. They couldn't sort out the bodies, so they scooped them all up and took them, buried them at Arlington. Well, the next day being 9/11, we obviously didn't go. The following day, the Admiral of the Embassy gave Denise and I a lunch, and he said, perhaps I shouldn't tell you, but both of you were booked on Flight 77 that crashed into the Pentagon. And only because John Howard asked you to go with him, we pulled you off on a later flight. So I continue to vote for John Howard when he was alive. The British press at the time of the Great White Fleet went to work with a will, trying to downgrade the importance of any visit to Australia of the Great White Fleet. They even questioned our loyalty to the mother country. Australia was not expected to be a petulant child stamping its foot as we're not getting our own way. Colonials should be aware of their proper place within the hierarchy of the empire. Let me go forward to 1940. I was serving in HMAS Australia as a midshipman, attached to the British Home Fleet. We'd been seconded to the Royal Navy Support Force with General de Gaulle's debacle at Dakar. We'd been twice hit by French shells. They shot our aircraft down and lost the three crew, and we sunk one of their destroyers. We were in dry dock at Liverpool in December, subject to a number of heavy raids by German bombers. I was taken home for a weekend by an English wren, whose father was the MP for Birkenhead. Her rather formidable mother, who certainly believed the family belonged to the upper class, found me cleaning my shoes. She snatched them from me, saying, "Naval officers do not clean shoes. We've got servants to do that." I had 10 days leave due, and Mother said, "We must get you away from Liverpool and all the bombing. We've got friends on a farm in Wales. That'll be much safer for you." I protested I shouldn't be thrust upon the family. Mother said, "Oh, don't worry. They're Canadian. Only colonials. Just like you." Back to the Great White Fleet. Rear Admiral Evans was in command of 4 divisions, each of 4 battleships, as he led his fleet up the west coast of South America to enter San Francisco to a great welcome. He was suffering from gout and was forced to hand over command to Rear Admiral Sperry, who led his fleet to sea on July 7, 1908 to start the Pacific League of the Tour. There they are at sea, where they're saying it's a long haul from San Francisco over to New Zealand and Australia, and they were doing some exercises on the upper deck with their rifles as they steamed across the Pacific. The 1st Division had USS Connecticut. Thank you. That's the 15 of the 16 captains who commanded the battleships in their dress uniforms. So the flagship was Connecticut, and in that division was Kansas, Vermont, Louisiana. Next one. That's the crew of the Connecticut, all lined up. 14,000 sailors about to descend upon Australia. The 2nd Division was the Georgia, New Jersey, Rhode Island and Virginia. The 3rd, Minnesota, Maine, Missouri, Ohio. And the last division, Alabama, Illinois, Carange and Kentucky. They had a number of fleet auxiliaries, a torpedo tender. They arrived in New Zealand in Auckland to spend the 9th of August to the 15th to a great reception from New Zealand. Now it sailed for Sydney. Thank you. A rather clever cartoon with Uncle Sam being in the position of Cape York. We went quite mad with our postcards. They were jingoistic, and you'll see some of them in a moment. Sailed for Sydney to arrive there on August the 20th for a 7-day visit. Sydney viewed the visit of the Great White Fleet as a sign that any aggressive move from the Japanese Navy would be thwarted by an American fleet. The Russians had been defeated and the British had vacated the Pacific. The remaining vacuum could only be filled by America. A local comment was, "We've never seen a single battleship. Now we've got 16 in Sydney Harbour." The reception was overwhelming. Allow me to quote from James Rettner's book, Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet. So intense was Australia's and Sydney's interest in the visit, one half of the population remained awake the entire night. Thousands and thousands, long before night was over, were on their way to the hilltops outside the city limits, where they massed in unbroken lines to view the spectacle. An estimate of the viewers varies from 500,000 to 650,000. That's 100 years ago. Thank you. Part of the cards that were produced, we've got always the Australian, the American flag, the Australian coat of arms, America, and the date. And I think the Port Melbourne Historical and Preservation Society have unearthed a gentleman who's got 700 cards that emanated from this time. Thank you. There's our Australian lady embracing an eagle. Very symbolic.
Another one too.
Here they are marching in Sydney, and you actually get them marching. It's designed to look as if they're marching down the street, and they had a huge reception in Sydney. I think there's one more perhaps. Thank you. Yes, there we are, Australia and the eagle, and sometimes the Eureka flag gets used, but a little bit across the bottom tells you all. And finally, on August the 27th, the fleet disengaged itself from Sydney's embrace and sailed out through the heads, turned south and headed for Melbourne. When the fleet sailed, 91 had failed to report, but USS Yankton stayed behind, and when she proceeded, 60 of them had become aboard, leaving 30 with the girls in Sydney. Melbourne turns it on. Thank you. Well, that's the last bit of it. Nice little bit of poetry telling you the Southern Cross, and we found a new partner. The one before that, please.
Oh, sorry.
You can go back one.
If I can.
There they are, just entered Port Phillip, and that's off Queenscliff on the 29th of August 1900. The locals in Melbourne knew they had to really turn it on to beat Sydney.
Yeah.
On Saturday, the fleet entered Port Phillip just after 11 o'clock in the morning. Crowds lined the foreshore, small boats greeted the majestic battleships to accompany them 30 miles up the bay, where they dropped anchor in two lines of eight off Williamstown about 3 in the afternoon. Thank you. This is rather a misty one of Queenscliff, but you can see the crowds on the foreshore and in the distance the ships. HMAS Cerberus, she was now HMAS, having gone from the Victorian Navy to the Australian Navy on Federation, was anchored at the entrance to the Yarra. She returned the fleet salutes. It happened to be the American Admiral Sperry's birthday, so they fired another salute to him. The monitor was now 40 years old, tending to look her age against the might of the United States. She was spawned at a different naval era. Melbourne was about to turn on American Week. Melbourne, of course, was the seat of government, so there's the front of the program produced for Melbourne, where we had the cabinet meet, and on the Sunday, we'll go back to the Boys Brigade. The Ballarat Boys Brigade wished to visit the Great White Fleet, and they requested railway passes from the government. The Premier was Tommy Bent.
Oh, yeah.
His statue, as you know, he was bent a bit too, I think.
Yeah.
He growled, "Let them walk." And that's exactly what the boys did. They marched over 5 days from Ballarat to Melbourne. There was such a great commotion about them not having rail passes, the government didn't dare not send them home other than by rail, they were showered with gifts, and the railway people had to put an extra carriage on just to carry all the gifts the boys had been given to take them back to Ballarat. Now, there is no longer a boys' brigade or naval cadets in Ballarat, but there's a training ship in Bendigo, and when Don and I and Kathy go up there on the 25th, they're having a civic reception at 9 o'clock in the morning, and the boys from Bendigo are going to reenact, I understand, a small part of the march that they did in 1908. Rear Admiral Sperry goes ashore. On Sunday the 30th of August, Rear Admiral Sperry landed from Kilda Pier to attend a reception tendered by the Australian Prime Minister and the Cabinet. The next day, a naval brigade landed here at Port Melbourne. They had to march along the dusty streets of the city, where people lined up in huge numbers, climbing the lampposts to get a better view and have a look. Thank you. That's Melbourne's, one of Melbourne's, with the state's symbols around the centre one, the American Australian flag. Thank you. Map of Port Phillip and Melbourne they gave to the sailors so they wouldn't get lost when they got here. Thank you. Now, the Freemasons invited all the Masons on board, and they got about 1,000 to go to look after them. Of course, the Roman Catholics, not to be outdone, ran a special mass at St. Patrick's, and they got 1,000 sailors to go to mass. So the fight was even. Thank you. There they are marching down Thornton Street, with the town hall very evident. And it really was a big do, and Melbourne absolutely embraced them, as did Sydney. On the Thursday, they held a huge military review at Flemington Racecourse, probably the highlight of the visit. At it, there were 8,000 Victorian cadets, including the Ballarat boys. They put on a big dinner on Thursday night. A lavish dinner for 3,000 sailors was set up at the exhibition building. Come the start time of 7 o'clock, one lone sailor was present. By 9 o'clock they had 7. With the female company in full supply, why would a sailor want to leave his newfound girlfriend to attend a dreary dinner with his shipmates he sailed with every day? From the girl's point of view, they were reluctant to give up their exciting escorts to be left alone, to be reenacted over the 40s once again. Thank you. There they are in Melbourne. That's the same postcard duplicated, obviously, but you can see the density of the crowds and how much interest the visit actually brought to Melbourne. Thank you. One of the postcards, that's the town hall, obviously, and the exhibition buildings with the state's shield, the various flags and the wattle, and they really went to town. Thank you. That's a souvenir, a rather nice key ring they produced. They had a really great time. Of course, all the shopkeepers obviously made a killing. There's so much available to recognise the visitors of the Great White Fleet. There might be another one. Yes, here we've got Teddy Roosevelt on the left with Alfred Deakin and the visit, and the two coats of art, well, the kangaroo and the eagle on the right, both very symbolic. Rather a nice presentation when you think it's 100 years ago that they produced that. Thank you. Hands across the sea. They're all very patriotic, as you can well see. There might be one more. This is a postcard of the bridge, and our dear friend has made a note on it. I've walked over the bridge. A lot of them sent home postcards, and one had said, I hope you're being good to his girlfriend in the States, but I think he really meant, I'm being good while I'm here, which is probably doubtful. after they had problems with coal, Levy's dinner, the sailors were fated, free rail passes were available, some went to Bendigo, some went up to Healesville, balls were turned on, homes were opened, all were treated like heroes. Liberty was supposed to end at 11 p.m. on Friday the 4th of September. The fleet to sail the next day. The last quarter of a mile to the railway station was through packed crowds gathered to say goodbye. The girls hugged and kissed the sailors, struggling to reach the station. Their tunic buttons were grabbed as souvenirs. Little wonder that some of the US sailors chose to take permanent leave of the Navy in Melbourne. On the first count, 85 failed to return. The figure soon rose to 221. Problems with coaling. Only two of the six British colliers to coal the US fleet turned up. Perhaps Britain was merely demonstrating that Australia was still dependent upon her. Rear Admiral Sperry had to go to the local market to buy coal and could only get rather inferior coal instead of the beautiful Welsh steaming coal that the British colliers had. It was time for tears. Fleet-bitten girls rose on Saturday morning, went to the edge of the bay to wave heartbroken to the departing armada. Others got up with the object of their affection still there. On Saturday morning, the 5th of September, 15 battleships departed, leaving the Kansas behind to collect any mail and any other mails that had not returned. When she sailed on the 10th, she had 450 bags of mail and 100 stragglers. Still ashore, unaccounted for, between 100 and 115 deserters. How fascinating it would be to actually track down some descendants from those who stayed and hear their stories. The visit to Sydney and Melbourne of the Great White Fleet was a huge success. Politically, the visit had vindicated Deakin's decision to contact directly President Roosevelt and invite his ships. The visit of a powerful force raised the awareness of Australians to our vulnerability and the need for a Navy under our own control. Members of the Great White Fleet later voted Melbourne was the best Liberty port in the whole world tour. We received royal assent from King George V to prefix Australian Navy with Royal. Thus, on July 10, 1911, the Royal Australian Navy came into being. The Navy had outgrown the Bay Street Drill Hall, and in 1942, a new drill hall was built on the lagoon site to open the headquarters of Lonsdale. You should have played. There's the drill hall. It was 1912, not 1911. Still there. The post office on the corner, built in 1888. And the Commonwealth gave the drill hall to the state government. At the time it was Liberal. And for some unaccountable reason, they gave it to Circus Oz for years. And Circus Oz's headquarters is in there. We are very hopeful that they might move on before too long and we might be able to get it back. Anybody who'd ever served in the Navy in World War II in Victoria would have had the prefix PM attached to their official number. PM stood for Port Melbourne. They thus carried with them over their career the fact that they joined the RAN at Port Melbourne, and thousands fell into that category. In 1992, Lonsdale was decommissioned. The site was cleared to give way to a high-rise apartment block called HMAS. The long naval association with the city of Port Melbourne ended. It came to a sad end, and today no one would ever know the Navy had ever been in the precinct. The Naval Heritage Foundation of Australia. In January this year, an interested group of the Navy family incorporated the Naval Heritage Foundation of Australia. One of our objectives is to erect a 1.25 times normal size bronze statue of a World War II sailor at Port Melbourne, adjacent to the site of the Old Town Pier, demolished in 1950. Since the mid-1850s, the Colonial Navy, thousands of naval men and women have served their country in war and peace. There is not a single marker to remember all who passed this way. Thank you. That's the answering the call model of the statue. We hope to honour and remember those who served. I'm proud to be the president of that foundation. My thanks for your attention and your patience. And it should be a great patience. Thank you.